Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon. My name is Brian Topher, Principal Architect of Topher Architecture, and you are listening to New Books Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network dedicated to architecture and its publications. If you have any suggestions on authors who you'd love to hear me speak with next, feel free to send me an email at btopher@topherarchitecture.com. Today's guest is Christina Crawford to talk about her book, Spatial Revolution. Christina, thank you very much for being here with me today, and welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. I'm really delighted to be able to talk about my book.
Oh, same here. Now, before we begin, can you tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I'm an associate professor of architectural history in the art history department at Emory University in Atlanta. I just received tenure, so it felt really
Congratulations. Good
to say associate professor. I mean, not that it matters to anyone outside of academia, but so I'm an architectural historian, and I'm also a trained and in fact, still licensed architect. So I guess just to draw it out a little bit and maybe to set up the discussion, I'll tell a little bit kind of further deep in my biography. So to kind of explain where this book comes from. So going back to 1990, I did a gap year between high school and college, and was an exchange student in the Soviet Union. So the very last year of the Soviet Union, sort of as it was falling apart, so 1990 to 91. And I lived with a Russian family, and that's how I learned how to speak and read and write Russian. And that's, you know, in a way, like that's the core of my interest in, you know, the whole kind of that whole geography of Eastern Europe, Eurasia. And then when I was in college, I sort of continued to study Russian and Eastern European studies and also architecture. So always wanted to be an architect. And basically, you know, from college and then, you know, to the present day, I kept in a way sort of going back and forth between these two interests. So I actually worked for the Foreign Service for a year in St. Petersburg, Russia. Then I went to architecture school. Then I took another gap year in architecture school and was a Fulbright student in Ukraine. And then I practiced in Boston as an architect for 8 years. And so we sort of, you know, back, forth. And then finally decided, you know what, I'm going to get a PhD and I'm going to figure out a way to marry these two interests. And so there you go. There's the book. I mean, it's the, it's the marriage of, you know, kind of interest in the practice of architecture. And then also, you know, this particular geography and chronology of the Soviet Union.
And so that would have been my first question, you know, very specific time period, very specific place. And so I guess you kind of answered, you know, where that interest comes from.
Yeah.
And so that's great. And so we've jumped right in now. And so again, I would start kind of with the broad question of, you know, and you've broken yours up into three parts. You know, what, for those who haven't had the chance to read the book yet, what are you trying to explain to the readers?
Yeah, I mean, so I guess, you know, as I explained, my interest in Soviet architecture, you know, certainly goes back to college. and grad school. And yet every time I encountered, you know, kind of material about Soviet architecture, certainly the beginning of the Soviet period, it was always about the avant-garde. So Russian avant-garde, you know, focused on Moscow, paper projects, right? So unbuilt projects. And so the I would say like the big motivating question of the book then and the research was, okay, love these really, really visionary paper projects, but like what was built, right? So what was actually built in this time? And further, like what, like how were architects and planners, so how were the practitioners kind of understanding their work? Especially like in the early Soviet period where we're, you know, transitioning from capitalism to socialism, like what the heck does that mean in terms of like spatial practices, right? So what I'm trying to do in the book is kind of get at this question. So what was being built? How are the architects and planners, and of course, like governmental officials and such, like how are they kind of framing their spatial project? And what were they building, right? So the book strings together three different sites. So Baku, which is in present-day Azerbaijan, which was an oil city. So, you know, kind of replanned very early because, you know, it was the Soviet oil bank. The second city that I look at is Magnitogorsk, which is a, you know, big steel city. And then the last is Kharkiv in Ukraine, which was a kind of a machine building city. And so I, you know, and those kind of march along in chronology, you know, in a kind of chronology from like 1924 to 32. And each of these sites is kind of learning something from its predecessor. You know, I really got in the weeds and really was trying to understand, like, you know, like trying to get my head in the architects' heads, right? Like what were they up to, right? So that's the kind of like the big the kind of big overview of what.
No, that's perfect. And so I guess not we're gonna go linear, but you know, starting with you mentioned Baku, and again, yeah. I'm always honest about whatever assumptions I bring into the books I read, and mm-hmm. how I'm almost always kind of proven wrong or learn something new. You know, you mentioned people's perception of Soviet architecture, and I'm willing to admit that I think like a lot of people when you hear about Russian architecture, you think of, you know, the Kremlin, big dome, stereotypical buildings you see on TV.
Yep.
And so the first, you know, Baku, and again, I'm going to butcher this name. It's very interesting that you make a few cases where there was a lot of American influence, unless I'm completely misunderstanding, mm-hmm. on kind of what they're building. And again, I'm going to butcher this. Is it Severosky?
My protagonist in Baku, yeah, Serebrowski. There you go.
I knew I was going to mess that up. But so, you know, it's an interesting thought that I've never really thought of about the American influence and I think specifically mass production of housing. And again, maybe I'm kind of missing the point here, but could you walk us through that a little bit?
So I guess, you know, I as, you know, a person who grew up in the 80s, let's say, like had a very... you know, in retrospect, a very kind of Cold War understanding of the relationship between the Soviet Union and the U.S. and understood the Soviet Union to be like completely on its own, let's say. But in the 1920s and early 1930s, there was just like an incredible kind of exchange of ideas about, like specifically about industrial architecture. And this is why the Americans become so important, is that, you know, Detroit, Cleveland, Gary, Indiana. I mean, these are all like really, really important industrial architecture sites that the rest of the world is looking at. And certainly the Soviets are looking at. So, you know, architectural standardization, architectural mass production, whether it's in industrial building or in housing, the Soviets were very, very aware, visiting the United States, hiring American architects and technical specialists to bring their expertise to the Soviet Union. So that really surprised me. I did not know that going into the research.
I know, and so, as I said, you know, I just like you said, I was also not expecting to see so many American names in this kind of. And so again, I guess we will move linear. We don't often literally go through, but you know, moving on to kind of your second part of the book, you know, when we started this discussion, you had mentioned there's a lot of projects that were on paper but never got built. However, I do think it is sort of worth discussing a lot of the competitive kind of theoretical stuff that was actually happening.
Yeah. Yeah, so you're talking specifically about like the Magnitogorsk, like the competition there.
Yes, and I was not going to be able to pronounce that.
Yeah, exactly. And that so that site, it's so the three sites I should have mentioned. So Baku is in present day Azerbaijan. Magnitogorsk is in Russia, but it's in the like on the far side of the Urals, like almost Siberia. And then Kharkiv, the last one, is in Ukraine. So there's a kind of diversity of geography. But at any rate, so Magnitogorsk was, you know, it was located where it was because there was this, you know, kind of natural mountain of iron ore, which is, you know, and that was the raw material that was needed for the steel factory. But it was like, I mean, totally in the middle of nowhere. So, and you know, that particular site, so we're talking 1929, it's like the chronology actually is quite important. So 1929, the Soviet first 5-year plan starts, which is a sort of big hyper-industrialization drive. The world economy crashes, right? So the Soviets are on the upswing, like the rest of the, you know, capitalist world is on the downswing. And Magnitogorsk is an interesting case because it, because there was, I mean, literally nothing there. It was a site where there was a really important architectural competition and planning competition, where some avant-garde architects, some, you know, kind of more everyday practicing architects were thinking about, like, what does a socialist city look like? And they actually designed it, you know, for this competition, which, you know, there was no winner for. And ultimately, after the failed competition, which is super, super interesting and worth reading about, I hope you agree, the Soviets were then like, oh, well, maybe we should just hire somebody who actually has done this before. And so they hired the German architect Ernst May, who had done a lot of housing, mass-produced housing in Germany, to come and design the city. So complicated story, but pretty interesting.
No, absolutely. And I actually went to the appendix and read the competition brief.
You did. I'm so glad.
Yeah, I did.
Like, for architects, I just, like, I could not believe that find. I was like, this is exactly what I want to know. Like, right? How are they framing the problem architecturally? And it's incredibly, incredibly specific, you know, down to like, you know, square footages for this and that, you know. It's really amazing.
And I'll have to urge everyone who does pick up a copy to read that part as well. And so I gave you fair warning about this. So moving on to the third part, you know, Kharkiv, I think obviously the elephant in the room, the thing with Russia and Ukraine, definitely at the forefront of a lot of people's minds now, where it probably wasn't not too long ago. And so I do want to talk about your focus before we move on to that question of, you know, how have I'm sure people are asking you a lot about, probably more so, but based on the current events. I'm sorry. Hopefully that question makes sense.
Yeah. So, so right. So since, you know, February 24th, 2022, when, you know, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, it's, I've had to do like a fair amount of kind of soul searching myself, like to try to think about, what it is that I researched and I wrote in the book, and like, what are the implications for what we're seeing today? And I think that there are some, but maybe to back up, to just explain kind of what those last two chapters in that last, part of the book is about. So Kharkiv is so it's in eastern, like northeastern Ukraine. And the city, it's the second largest city in Ukraine, sort of historically very important city, and with a lot of, educational institutions, universities, amazing architecture. Like, I can't stress this enough. So when this is all over, like, I hope a lot of tourists, architectural tourists, go there because it's phenomenal. But the story that I tell in the book is about the design and construction of a tractor factory on the outskirts of Kharkiv and the socialist city, kind of like the residential area that's designed and built for the tractor factory workers. And in the book, there's a reason that I put it last, because I think, the way that I wrote about it in the book is like, this is a success, right? And like, there's this kind of through line in the book that says, basically, when the Soviets kind of started this project in the 1920s, let's say, like, they had no idea what socialist architecture was going to be. Like, they're figuring it out as they go along. And by the time they get to Kharkiv, it becomes clear that in order to kind of populate, and in a way kind of internally colonize the Soviet Union, standardized architecture is going to be the answer, right? You design like a certain number of types, whether it's like factories or housing. And then once you have those types and they're working pretty well, you can just like blow up, like, put them anywhere, basically, right? And what I found in Kharkiv is that both the tractor factory itself, but then also the housing, they use a very limited number of types, and like, boom, like instant city, right? And then, when you were talking before about when you said, when people think of Soviet architecture, Russian architecture, I thought you were going to say, like, people think of the big concrete high rises.
Oh, I see.
That's usually what I get. Like, not that's the onion dome. People are like, why would you ever study like Soviet architecture? It's so dull, and right. But that was when, if the state's building everything, you choose a limited number and you just do it again and again and again, right? So at any rate, the Kharkiv was a kind of architectural success story, I would say. But then, after the war started, I thought more about that and really started to think about specifically that whole eastern part of Ukraine that Kharkiv is part of, includes the Donbass, which again is a, kind of a place that probably was not on most people's mental map before the war and is now. I mean, it was part of this whole like really massive kind of industrialization of that whole part of Ukraine, mostly led by kind of Russian speakers. And it was a kind of a colonizing effort, in effect, and architects were implicated in that. And in fact, like I don't write about it in the book, but have since done a little bit of research, the steel factory, the Azovstal factory, that was the real kind of holdout in Mariupol, was also a first 5-year plan project started in 1929, 1930. So these projects that I was so excited about, just kind of like as an architect, now feel very dark to me. Yeah. I have to say. So at any rate, I've been doing quite a lot of lecturing and trying to share information, just with people about Ukrainian architecture and the importance of kind of understanding the built environment there.
Well, that's a perfect segue. So often one of my final questions is, now that the book's been finished, what's your next project? What's occupied your time? I think you've kind of gone to that question quite a bit already. But so I guess besides the lecturing and also kind of revisiting your subject matter, I guess what other projects are in the future? What else occupies your time? So yeah, the question I have is, even though you kind of gave it away with your lecturing and revisiting some of your subject matter, I guess what's next for you now that the book's finished?
Yeah, I mean, I have a couple projects. The next book that comes out is a co-edited book with Claire Zimmerman and Jean-Louis Cohen that's called Detroit, Moscow, Detroit. And is specifically, there 13, 14 essays in there. And I write specifically about, it takes place between, let's say, 1928, 1932, same chronology, but really focuses on these exchanges between American technical consultants and the Soviet Union. So I write, my chapter in that book is about, I read through, it was fun, actually, I read through the memoirs of American consultants who went to the Soviet Union and then came back and then kind of wrote about what they, their experiences. So that's one project. And then the second project that I'm working on now is about, also about transnational architectural exchange, but specifically about housing, so worker housing. And the first federally funded public housing in the US was in Atlanta, which is where I now live. And so the next book will be about the ways in which kind of European ideas about worker housing in a way got kind of like brought into the US through Atlanta, kind of filtered, let's say, through Jim Crow South, and then kind of exported to other sites in the US. So I'm very interested in like these big map kind of questions about how architecture travels. You know, ideas and forms in architecture travel. So,
wow, perhaps yeah. We can talk again in the future then.
Yeah. Whenever that is done in, you know, a million years, hopefully yes. Not that long.
Yeah. I know it's not as quick.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you again. I know there's so much more we could cover, but I don't want to keep you here all day. So,
well, thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks for reading the book. I'm really delighted that you derived pleasure from that competition brief in the back of the book, because it is, I mean, it totally blew me away.
Agreed. Yes. And for everyone listening, as I said, you'll make sure you check that part out. And so, yeah. So thank you again for speaking with me.
My pleasure. And can I make one last little plug? I didn't ask you if I could do this, but I have been thinking a lot about Ukraine recently. And for the architects who are listening, if you are interested to make any donations to any institution, there's a private school of architecture called the Kharkiv School of Architecture that had to leave Kharkiv because of the war, is now in Western Ukraine in Lviv. But they are training like the future Ukrainian architects who are going to rebuild after the war. So if you go to their website, Kharkiv School of Architecture, it's very easy to donate to them. So that's my little pitch.
No, yeah. When this goes live, I'll certainly have them put the link on the landing page.
That would be just absolutely great. I can't speak highly enough about them.
Well, thank you so much. And again, thank you for that. And for everyone listening, the book is Spatial Revolution. And please check out the link, which you've probably seen since you've gotten to this episode. So thank you all and have a great day.
Great. Thanks, Brian.